Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure that you go check out everything that 1517 is doing, because there's a lot of stuff. You know, I took a break from pushing events and that sort of stuff because, you know, Here We Still Stand sold out in like 17 days. It sold out so quickly. And if that's disappointing to you and you're bummed out, there is an opportunity for you that we haven't pushed that much in gorgeous Bentonville, Arkansas, May 5th and 6th. You can come to the regional event, the Here We Still Stand regional event. That's May 5th and 6th. It's like $99 to come, and a two-day thing. There's going to be a bunch of speakers there. Chad's going to be there. I'm going to be there. A bunch of other people. You can check out the whole list. Concert happening Friday night, which is going to be a blast. The Arcadian Wild's going to be there. If you don't know who that is, it's a great group out of Nashville. Check out all the stuff. I'll put a link in the show notes, but you can register for that. That will sell out as well. We've done it a couple years in a row. It's sold out every year. There are tickets available for it right now because we have not really promoted it. But if you are hoping to go to San Diego and you cannot because it's sold out, come on over here. If you're just wanting to go to an event because you've never been to an event, this is a great one to check out. So all the information is over at 1517.org. All right, Chad, we are in 2 Kings, the tail end of chapter 23. The northern kingdom is gone, and we're going to get to kind of talk about the aftermath and what else happens after that. But the sort of big thing that we had been leading up to for months has happened in the last episode.
Yeah, we finally got to 722 BC, which is that infamous date when the northern kingdom finally had its funeral, and they ended up getting exiled, which is the way that 2 Kings 17:23 ends. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. So what we're going to transition into in verse 24 is basically a shuffling of peoples. So you got the northern kingdom, you got all those tribes being moved elsewhere, and then you have other peoples being moved to where the northern kingdom was, which is what we're introduced to in verse 24. We read that the king of Assyria brought people from, well, there's a whole list here, Babylon, Cuthah, Avah, Hamath, Sepharvaim, so all these various places, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. So really what you have taking place here, I mean, it's not a precise parallel, but more or less, it's a reversion to the pre-Joshua days, where you had the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, all these various ites living in the land of promise. And then, of course, under Joshua, the people of Israel come in, they conquer, they settle there. And now, after centuries of idolatry and rebellion, they're removed, and you have these other people coming in. They're not all the Perizzites and Hivites, but they are the people from Babylon and Cuthah and Ava and so on and so forth. So they're going to be moved in, and they're going to basically take over the homes, the cities, the fields, the vineyards of the people of Samaria. So what happens? Well, things don't go well. Verse 25 says, at the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear the Lord. And one of the things to kind of keep in mind about this section, especially verses 24 through 33, is that what we're being presented with here is not a depiction of how things should be, but simply a depiction of what happened. Okay, so this is going to be kind of from an outsider's viewpoint, because what we're going to be introduced to is that, you know, you got to fear the God of the land, as if Yahweh is just a kind of a local deity. So the situation is, things didn't go well at first. Why? Well, because they didn't fear Yahweh. And as we've discussed many times on the podcast, to fear is not simply to be afraid of. To yara in Hebrew, to fear the Lord, is an all-encompassing, holistic word that includes reverence, worship, being afraid, to be sure, trusting, all those sorts of things. So they didn't fear the Lord. So what did God do? Well, if He were God, what would you do? What would you do, Dan? Would you send a preacher, or would you send something else?
Well, I mean, God does like to send a preacher.
We got some other kind of preachers that are coming up here, though.
That's right. A lot of what is going on in the Northern Kingdom, like we talked about, how you're not talking about like a complete wipeout. Like there's people that get left and remain, and then
sure,
all this kind of stuff. All of this actually matters if you're more familiar with the New Testament and you're like, what's the deal with Samaria, right? And you're trying to, and you're like, why is there, what's hostility? What's the, why is it that like Jews don't have any dealings with it? Like this, this is where all of this is starting, right? I mean, like where you're going to start having the disintegration of any kind of real fidelity to God that, that doesn't end up getting syncretized with other things, and then you, so you have like a sort of this sort of impure religion going on. So you have Jewish people, but then you have the Israelites also marrying with other people, and this is where that tension is, which I think that's correct. I mean, this is like kind of like where that's really starting, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is where it all starts. It isn't where it all ends. This is just off the cuff, but I think I remember kind of the general flow of what happened. So in 2 Kings 17 is where the origins of what came to be called Samaria. Of course, keep in mind that this is, I mean, we're 7 centuries away from the time of the New Testament. So it starts here, and as we'll see in just a minute, what you basically have is the Yahweh and worship going on. So you got the syncretism that we've encountered many other times. So that's kind of how it starts. And then over time, there's kind of actually a strange development. So we know, for instance, in Ezra and Nehemiah's time, so this is after the Babylonian exile, so a couple of centuries into the future, when the Jews return, they start to rebuild the temple, that they meet opposition from the people of Samaria, who claim to have been worshiping the Lord. Now, they probably worship other gods too, but they wanted to team up with them to rebuild the temple. And Ezra and other leaders were like, no, we're going to do it on our own. Well, you fast forward and to the time of the Maccabees, 2nd century BC, then you have ongoing conflict between the Jews and the Samaritans. And somewhere along there, probably around the time of Alexander the Great, the Samaritans basically say, we're going to do this on our own. And they build their own temple at Mount Gerizim, which was later destroyed by one of the Maccabean rulers, John Hyrcanus. And then, so you go through this whole history, you get to the time of the New Testament, the Samaritans have their own copy of the Torah. We know from John 4, the woman at the well in Samaria, that they have a messianic expectation. But they also have, they're like sort of cousins, theological cousins to the Jews, but they have their own thing going on here. Where there's still these many differences between the Jews and the Samaritans. There's overlap. There's also significant differences.
Well, you might be like, why are you bringing this up? If you're wondering why you read passages like Jews had no dealings with Samaritans in the Gospels, or woman at the well, should we worship on this mountain or that mountain? This is where this is starting to happen. And you were saying that, you know, theological cousins and actual cousins. No doubt. So when you say Jews had no dealings with Samaritans, the Jews didn't consider Samaritans Jews, even though they shared blood. Now it's probably all mingled up and there's other things going on there, but they aren't unrelated.
Right. Right.
At least some of them.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there would have been a lot of mixed marriages going on between the Jews who stayed behind and these people that were brought in. So you got a mixture of bloodlines. You got a mixture of theology. You have, you know, plenty of things in common, but also some pretty significant differences. One of my favorite differences between the Jews and the Samaritans. So if you go to the Samaritan Pentateuch, their copy of the Torah, they've inserted a verse that says that God wanted the temple to be built at Mount Gerizim. So, you know, playing fast and loose with the biblical text there and inserting something, which, of course, legitimizes their place of worship. But anyway, yeah, I mean, 2 Kings 17 is important background from the New Testament because, like you say, this is the Genesis. This is where Samaria's history began, and it did change over time, but this is its beginning and not a very positive beginning, because when they didn't fear the Lord, getting back to what I said earlier, what did God do? Well, he sent preachers a lot of times. In this case, though, he sent a different kind of preacher. He sent a lion, lions. to preach some law to these folks.
Hey, and Kings, he sent some bears. God will send an animal.
Yeah, God is not. God used animals a lot of times. He used a big fish to swallow Jonah. He used locusts lots of times to bring plagues on the people. He used snakes in the wilderness.
He used Balaam's ass.
Yeah, he used Balaam's ass as a preacher, and he's used lions before. So he sent lions, and I don't think there's lions in Israel today, but there certainly were in ancient times. And if you get down by the Jordan River, that's some pretty thick, brushy country. That was a dangerous place for lions. So anyway, he sends lions, which killed some of them. Probably killed a lot of them, because this threat and these deaths reached the ear of the king of Assyria. He was told, "The nations that you carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land." Again, this is from their perspective. So he sent lions among them, and behold, they are killing them because they don't know the law of the God of the land. So, of course, according to the theological understanding of the Assyrians, most of the time you had deities who were geographically circumscribed. So they, you know, God of this land, God of that land. So they don't know the God of the land. So we got to do something about that. Well, the Assyrian king says, "Well, why don't you get one of the priests that we took away and send him back there so that he can teach them the law of the God of the land?" So that's what they did. Verse 28, one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. It's a simple solution. One of the strange things about this, though, is, so why were they exiled to begin with? Because the priest and everybody else in the northern kingdom were not worshiping the Lord. And now they get one of these same priests and they send him back to teach these people how to worship the Lord. So it's a pretty rich irony going on here.
It is. It seems that they, these people are, I don't know if they've put it together that the reason that they're exiled is because they didn't worship the Lord. They just think that they made some bad political decisions or something, or who knows what they think. But apparently it hasn't occurred to them that, you know, we probably wouldn't have gotten in this situation if we just listened to God, because he wouldn't have let it happen. That unbelief is real ignorant.
And, it is.
That's just the way it goes. But then, of course, you know, it's not rare at that time also. I mean, if you have lions that are eating people and stuff, it wouldn't be that weird to think that God was doing that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that would, back then, that would probably be a pretty natural assumption. Yeah. You know, when bad things start happening, you're like, the God or gods are offended. That would be a natural theological thought process that any of the ancient peoples would have gone through. So you need to do something different, placate his wrath or whatever it might be. So this priest shows up. He sets up his little seminary, his little school there in Bethel, and he starts to teach people how they should fear the Lord. Well, how does this go? Well, verse 29 tells us it really didn't go that great, because every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the shrines of the high places that the Samaritans had made. So they're taking advantage of the little shrines that were left behind. Every nation in the cities in which they live. So they're taught how to fear Yahweh, but, you know, they still have their other gods, and they're going to continue to worship them. So it's Yahweh andism.
I feel like this means that you didn't actually teach them how they should fear God. So here's how this can play out. If you're going to send a guy in there, you're going to send the theologian in, and they're going to do, you know, they're going to do a little theology class for you and stuff. And this is going to be all focused on, like, well, you know, you got to do the sacrifices this way, and, you know, this is what you need to do over here. And at no point does he really, really emphasize the singularity that God demands in worship. That he's, like, also, like, really important. Like, I could just see a situation where they're like, all right, we got to go teach the people what to do and not to do. When what you really needed to go and teach the people was, man, if there's just one thing I could say to you, it's only worship Yahweh. But I'm guessing you went in there and tried to, like, modify all the behavior and stuff without addressing this one thing, which is, like, that you only believe in him. Like, to fear, by the way, is to trust. So you only trust him, and everything else would be all right. But my guess is that you went and tried to fix everything else and at least didn't major on this point the way you needed to.
Yeah, he skipped the monotheism lecture, you know, and just kind of added Yahweh to the pantheon of these other.
Surely God won't mind if you have some other gods as long as you're behaving yourself.
Yeah, as long as you're behaving yourself and, you know, worshiping him in, you know, outwardly conforming sorts of ways. Well, you know, of course, this is exactly what did not happen. Everybody had their own little gods, their own little shrines. The men of Babylon, they made Sukuth-Benot. The men of Kuth made Nergal. The men of Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak. And the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and to Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. A whole list of peoples and gods there, but you get the point.
Man, these are everybody. These are some less famous gods right here, man. These are some of those obscure gods.
Very much so. Yeah, I was. I did a little research on each of these, and there's really not a whole lot there, honestly. I mean, these are just like local peoples from small areas that the Assyrians had conquered, and well, they each had their own, their own deities. Yeah. I mean, just not unlike the Edomites had theirs, the Ammonites had theirs, and the Philistines had theirs. Everybody had their every people group had their own respective deities.
These weren't those popular gods like, you know, Baal and Asherah and all this stuff where you're like, oh yeah, we know these gods. These gods are like, we got those, you know, hipster gods that no one else knows about. Like, yeah, you might be into Baal, but dude, like this god over here, this guy,
check him out.
Like no one knows about him.
100 people in the world that worship him.
I got to really, I can get to him anytime I want because there's not that many people that believe in him.
Yeah, so hold us to those kind of gods here. In verse 31, verse 32 says, not surprisingly, they worship these, but guess what? They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves all sorts of people as priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. And just in case, you know, you somehow, I don't know how, but just in case you've somehow missed the point, verse 33 sums it up for us. So they feared Yahweh, but also serve their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away.
In other words, they feared the Lord, but not the way that he wants to be feared.
Yeah, they feared him just like one among a bunch of other deities.
You know what they might be doing here is like actually fearing him a little bit, but not actually trusting him, which is the kind of fear that he's after. Right, so sure.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you could be afraid of Baal and Asherah and Molech and a lot of other gods in the ancient world, right? And you could be afraid of Yahweh too. But being afraid and biblically fearing are certainly not the same.
You might be you might be afraid of him and be like, hey, there are certain things that we got to do because those lions that wasn't fun. So let's make sure that we are acknowledging Yahweh among these other gods. We're going to acknowledge him, but we're also going to acknowledge these other things, and maybe that'll work. And like, that's exactly the thing that won't work.
Reminds me of the guy in the parables, the one who hid the bush, who hid the what does he hide?
Was it like the talent in the ground?
Yeah, the talent. He hides the talent in the ground because when the master gets back, he says, "I knew you were harsh.
Yeah,
I knew you were a harsh man. I was afraid of you." In other words, he didn't trust him. He was just afraid of him. Well, that's not biblical fear.
Yeah, no, that's the sort of thing. God gives you a gift, and you're like, oh, great, all this responsibility. Just like hide this somewhere. I don't want to mess it up. And you're like, it's just a gift, dude. Like, I mean, he didn't tell you even had to do anything with it.
Yeah.
No, that's not what God's after. God's not just after that. And that's an interesting thing because this fear of the Lord thing, because it began. I mean, real famously, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Wisdom. Yeah.
I mean, does it mean like terror of God? Is where it's at. Mm. That's not what it means. And it doesn't mean just acknowledging that God is sovereign or all-powerful or anything like that. It doesn't mean that either. It means to trust him and exclusively him.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that the demons fear God in the sense of they're afraid of him and tremble. Yeah, but that's, being terrified by God, being afraid of God, that's a pretty tiny aspect, actually, of actually what it means to fear the Lord. It's a... If trust is not involved in that fear, then it's not really a biblical. It's not a biblical fear.
And you don't actually fear him in this sort of trusting, believing, faith attached way, because you also fear other gods. And so he's, God is still not, does not hold the position of somebody that is so much bigger than whatever else is going on in these other places, other gods, that he would dwarf all of that and that you would have no use for such a thing. Your idea of God is still so much smaller than it should be if you're believing in any other gods. If you really understood like who God was, you wouldn't have no time for any other. You'd be like, well, I don't need any other gods. Like you obviously don't trust him the way that you ought to trust him, because if you did, the idea of other gods would be laughable to you. Like, I only need this God. This God does everything. Obviously, the catechism was not good in this.
The priest didn't do that great a job catechizing the people. So verse 34 is kind of a transition out of talking about these other peoples, but also talking about even the people who were exiled. So it starts out, to this day, they do according to the former manner. So this didn't change. They don't fear the Lord, and they do not follow the statutes or the rules of the law or the commandment that the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. So hearkening back all the way to Genesis 32 there. The Lord made a covenant with them and commanded them. And so I'm going to read through this. Listen to how many times you hear the phrase, you shall not fear other gods. So the Lord made a covenant with them and commanded them, you shall not fear other gods, or bow down to them, or serve them, or sacrifice to them. But you shall fear the Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt with great power and with an outstretched arm. You shall bow yourselves to him, and to him you shall sacrifice. And the statutes and the rules and the law and the commandments that he wrote for you shall always be careful to do. You shall not fear other gods, and you shall not forget the covenant that I've made with you. You shall not fear other gods. It's a broken record. But you shall fear the Lord your God, and he will deliver you out of all the hand of all your enemies. However, this is verse 40. However, they would not listen, but they did according to their former manner. So three times, you shall not fear the gods. In case you didn't hear me, you shall not fear the gods. You shall fear the Lord. So that is by far the dominant motif that's brought out here. And of course, it takes us back to Exodus 20 with the giving of the 10 words. It takes us all the way back to Genesis 32 with the changing of Jacob's name to Israel. It encompasses all of Exodus when God is described as the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt with great power and with an outstretched arm.
Yeah, I mean, if you thought that Chad and I were like really exaggerating, you know, I don't know, like the entirety of our time in 1st and 2nd Kings, probably Judges as well, really the whole history of Israel. If you thought we were exaggerating that, like, really what God is always talking about here is idolatry, and this is like the thing that's going to like end up messing up everything, this is why. Because like the text says it.
Yeah.
The text says, yeah, like the whole problem here, like there's a lot of stuff that these people do that is not good. It is worth reprimanding and correcting and all that stuff. But it doesn't matter because there's this thing going on, right? And so like until this is fixed, like none of the other stuff there's no point in addressing any of it. And God is I like this that it talks about, like, okay, don't serve other gods, don't fear other gods, don't fear other gods. And it says, but you shall fear the Lord your God, and he will deliver you out of the hand of all your enemies, right? So this is your problem. You just have a worship problem.
It's a worship problem. Yeah, that's all it is. I mean, yeah, so theoretically, suppose that the people of the Northern Kingdom, that coveting was not an issue up there. There was no theft whatsoever going on. Nobody was stepping out on a spouse. I mean,
no lying.
These were just like, no lying. I mean, these were just like morally superior people. Okay? I mean, they had their act together, just, you know, straight, narrow kind of folks. But despite all of that, they feared other gods and worshiped other gods. Well, it wouldn't matter. They would be in the exact same situation. Yeah. the morality is not going to help you out at all, no matter how good you are. It's not going to help you out whatsoever with God if it's still a matter of idolatry. Mm-hmm. And of course, I say theoretically, because if you get the first commandment wrong, you can get all the other commandments wrong as well. But It's a theological problem, not a moral problem in the Northern Kingdom. And of course, nothing has changed today. We can preach morality in every single sermon, and all our hearers will still all be condemned if the gospel is never preached.
That's
okay,
correct.
Last, I didn't read that last verse of the chapter. So these nations feared the Lord and also served their carved images, and their children did likewise, and their children's children, as their fathers did. So they do to this day. So not exactly, I mean, like real uplifting, positive sort of chapter, but hey, this is King. So if you've been listening along, you know that there's not going to be a lot of like super positive stories that are in First and Second Kings. But I will say this, but as we are leaving chapter 17 and stepping into chapter 18, we do have a nice and welcome surprise, because we're getting introduced to a guy who ends up being a very, very positive example of what the Lord is actually looking for, not only in an individual, but in a king. And of course, talking about Hezekiah. So 2 Kings 18, first verse. First of all, we're going to get our historical setting here. It's the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel. So that was the last king of the northern kingdom. So in his third year, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he started to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mom's name was Avi, the daughter of Zechariah. So we know the historical circumstances. We know the northern kingdom, as we just heard in chapter 17, is going to go down in a big way. They're going to be exiled. Assyrians going to take over, shift all these people into their territory. So that's what's happening in the north. Now in the south, we just came out from underneath the reign of a very bad king, Ahaz. We've talked about him before. He was not good. He was basically kissing the feet of the Assyrian king. He was doing everything he could to try and Assyrianize Jerusalem, make it like Assyria, both in its worship as well as its theology. So what we're going to see in these next few kings is kind of whiplash back and forth. You have a bad king, really bad king. Then you have a really good king. Then his son is going to be a really bad king. And then his son's going to be a really good king. So you're going to go back and forth, back and forth. So we had a bad king. Now we're going to be introduced to Hezekiah. And here is his glowing review. Verse 3, Hezekiah did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David, his father, had done.
Well, these are some of the rarest verses in the Old Testament. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. And by the way, just like they did what was evil, or he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, has to do with worship. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, also has to do with worship.
Yeah. So, and we have that spelled out for us in the next few verses. So after it says that he was very David-like, and I want to come back to his connection to David in a minute, and let's get some details. Well, if he was a right doer in the eyes of the Lord and very David-like in what he did, well, what exactly did he do? Well, number one, he finally got rid of the high places. We've heard about these high places over and over. In fact, usually if like you got a fairly decent king, it'll say he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, but, and the but is usually then followed by he didn't remove the high places. This guy did. Hezekiah got rid of the high places. He broke the pillars. He cut down the Asherah. The Asherah probably is indicative of that this was like some sort of special Asherah pole. Maybe it was in the temple, whatever. He got rid of it. So he's getting rid of all of these places where either you have rank idolatry, or certainly you have the possibility and probably the probability of idolatry taking place. He got rid of all that.
Dude, this and part, then, this part right here is wild to
it
me.
Is strange,
like, because it's not some. It's like one of those things where people are like, "Wait a minute, just let him read it." But hold on, you would have thought you'd have heard about this happening.
I know. That's what I was thinking just this morning. Like, I mean, hinted at maybe. No, yeah. Nowhere.
Like, it just pops in here and you're like, what? They were doing what?
Yeah. With that? Yeah, how long has this been going on?
Talk about take a good thing and then make it a idle thing. Like a god.
We didn't even
man.
Know that it was still around.
Yeah, I had no idea. Yeah, you, I mean, you wouldn't have known unless it. You would have thought that this is something that they talked about. It was located in the temple or something. Like you don't. I don't think you hear about this after Moses. You don't hear about this again.
Never comes up again. Yeah, everybody's wondering, like, the heck are you guys talking about? Well, here it is. So after we hear about him removing high places, breaking the pillars, cutting down the Asherah, it says he also, here's what else he did. He broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings. Now, in the Hebrew, that's burn incense. So they burn incense, or they made incense offerings to it. And it even had a name. It was called Nehushtan. So this takes us back all the way to the book of Numbers. You probably remember the scenario, the Israelites in the wilderness. They're doing the same thing they always did. They're grumbling, they're complaining, and they didn't believe in the Lord. They were grumbling about Moses, grumbling about God. And so he sends the serpents, right? And they bit the people. People cry out to the Lord. Moses. Moses intercedes for them. God says, make a serpent. Moses makes a bronze serpent, puts it on a pole. And everybody who looks at the bronze serpent after they were bitten by snakes, they were cured. They were healed. And of course, then that also is referenced by Jesus in John chapter 3.
Yeah, Jesus says this bronze serpent is me, right? Like just like this. I will be raised up. Here's what's fascinating about this. He doesn't just go in and say, hey, we're not doing this burning incense. We're not worshiping this bronze serpent anymore. We're not doing that. He breaks it into pieces. You're talking about something that Moses fashioned.
Yeah.
God uses to deliver people.
It's a radical move.
And he just smashes it. This dude's fidelity is way up there, because this would be like, this is a pretty important artifact. You know, this is a pretty important thing but he just smashes this into bit, which if it does anything, it should tell you this. Look, I'm sure there's people out there like, see, that's the problem with images. I understand what you're saying. It does give you pause about certain things like this. Like, is the bronze serpent cool? Absolutely. Is it a bummer that he had to smash that thing into bits so that you couldn't just like have it to remember what God had done as opposed to making it into an idol? That is a bummer. And should give you pause about any sort of, it doesn't matter if it's icons or what it is, that could be helpful. There are good things that become God things. And there is a line somewhere in there where, you know, you might have to smash it if you get too crazy. Now, Chad and I, we're not in a tradition that thinks that you can't have useful images and that kind of stuff, but there's obviously a line.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. Like, you summed it up when you said a good thing can become a God thing. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, so that can easily happen with... Well, all manner of good things. Art can become idolatrous. Statues, all that can become idolatrous. When we lose a focus upon it being an instrument through which God reveals what he's done for us, or a portrayal of what God has done for us. So we're not iconoclast. But at the same time, we acknowledge that, yeah, I mean, good things can certainly become idols. And Nehushtan is a great example of that. Moses himself crafted this. God himself commanded this. This was an Old Testament picture of Jesus, basically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This was like kind of, you could call this, this was the Old Testament crucifix. That's one way to look at it. When you were looking at this, you were seeing a pre-portrayal of Jesus on the cross. That becomes something to which they were burning incense. And so Hezekiah decides, you know what? It's got to go. Radical surgery taking place here. So, by the way, if you're wondering how we got this, why was it called Nehushtan? In Hebrew, bronze serpent is Nahash ha Nehoshet. And that those the same three Hebrew letters for the N, the H, and the SH are the same in all of those. So serpent is Nahash, bronze is Nehoshet, and so he's called Nehushtan. Even, you know, it wasn't, there was no name given back in Moses' day to this, but over time, that's what it even, you know, when it has a name, when it's given a name like this and incense is offered to it, then you know it has risen to the status of a false
god. When you give it, when you give it a name, you sort of person it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It becomes a, like an Asherah pole, basically, is what it boiled down, or like a, you know, a golden calf. So golden calf, bronze serpent, Asherah pole. They all unfortunately fell into the same category, but that it is strange. It's never mentioned after Numbers. There's no account whatsoever in like the temple being built where it was moved there, nothing like that. It just like comes crashing through the text here in 2 Kings 18.
By the way, verse 5 is a man, how'd you like to have this written about you?
Yeah, I mean, if this were my epitaph, that'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, this is pretty
he
good.
Trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. So that, I mean, that's great enough, you know. Chad trusted in God, but be fine with me.
Yeah.
But then goes on, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. Hezekiah, he's the man.
Yeah.
He's,
I mean, if you're wondering, who's the
top of the top?
Who's the greatest king in the history of Israel? Bible says it was Hezekiah. Like, I mean, that's what it says.
Pretty hard to argue with. I mean, we're going to meet a great guy, Josiah, in a few more chapters. But man, glowing words here spoken over Hezekiah.
You get the feeling that these high places and all this stuff were really, really just bugging God. And like, he's like, you know who the greatest king is? The guy that got rid of those, because that was really bothering me.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I want to come back to when it says, he did according to all that his father David had done. There's some pretty interesting parallel language that's incorporated into the description of Hezekiah, which actually points to this as well. So we hear how the Lord was with him. That's in verse 7. That same language is used in 1 Samuel 16, 18, when Jonathan talks about David. Or not. No, just describing him. This isn't Jonathan. Jonathan comes up in just a minute. So for 1 Samuel 16, 18 describes David as one with whom the Lord was. Also, we read that he prospered. That's in verse 7. And that same Hebrew verb, sakal, is used in reference to David. And we're also going to read in just a minute how he struck down the Philistines. And of course, David is famous for striking down the Philistines. So not only are we told explicitly that he was like his father, David, but also in this language that you used to describe him, you have a lot of parallels with the life of David.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is a reminder that, you know, we're used to typology in the New Testament where Christ is the last Adam, or you have the bronze serpent typology going on that we just talked about. But typology, where one person prefigures another person, where there's parallels between them, that happens already in the Old Testament, where David is kind of where Hezekiah is sort of a second David, is the way that we can think about him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
anyway,
I mean, that verse 8, when it says he struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and his territory from watchtower to fortified city, that sounds like it should be in 2 Samuel or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the language. That is the language of 2 Samuel. So David strikes down the Philistine giant, and now this Davidic king, Hezekiah, he strikes down the Philistines as well. So, I mean, glowing terms used to describe him. And we're going to see in the next episode what happens when he's faced with the threat of the Assyrians. So we'll see a couple of different sides of Hezekiah, and we'll be introduced to a pretty fascinating political speech that's given by an Assyrian as he stands outside the walls of Jerusalem, in which he tries to convince the people that they should not be trusting in Hezekiah nor in Hezekiah's God. So we'll get to that next week.
All right, sounds good. We will get into all that, Chad. I will see you next week.
We'll see you then.